welcome back to Emory's Creativity Conversations podcast. This is our third season with these introductory interviews taking place virtually. This podcast takes Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations, a live and endowed speaker series on Emory's campus, and turns them into podcasts. I'm Maggie Becker, the host of this podcast. I work for Arts at Emory, and I'm an Emory alum of theater studies and creative writing. We are recording this season's interviews over Skype to maintain COVID-19 social distancing precautions. I'm joined today by Stipe scholar and Emory student artist Nestor Lomeli to introduce the creativity conversation between playwrights Diane Glancy and Jack Dalton, moderated by Professor Michael Eventon. We should note that this creativity conversation was recorded in 2015, and a few years after that, playwright Jack Dalton was sentenced to 2 years in prison for attempting to engage in sexual abuse with a minor. While we are acknowledging that this has happened, we are approaching this conversation to discuss creativity with Nestor. The point of these introductions is to provide an exciting way to continue the conversation on creativity. Nestor and I will chat about the playwright's thoughts, Nestor's own work, and just creating in general. Nestor, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Nestor Lomeli. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. My parents are both from Mexico, but they both immigrated to Chicago in different times and met each other here. I am a current major of theater studies at Emory, while also minoring in film and media. A lot of what I do on campus is involved with student theater. I'm currently the artistic director for the student theater group, Julie's Players. I also am a playwright of my own, I would say. It just is more of a recent kind of, I think I've more recently have become a playwright, and I've started writing plays more seriously within the past year, which is why I chose the conversation with Jack Dalton and Diane Glancy. I figured it would be really interesting to learn about the craft of other playwrights and see how they put their story together.
How did you go from getting into theater? And then, I mean, there is a natural progression from once you start to study a craft to kind of trying your hand at all of it. But what was your step into theater and then your step into playwriting?
Yeah, so it was actually a pretty crazy ride, I would say. I came into Emory pre-med as a bio major. I was very ready to, you know, study for the MCAT. It was really hard my first year just because I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. I was struggling a lot academically with my classes. I didn't really have a passion for anything that I was taking, but I told myself that I would try theater because I was always interested in it. I figured, okay, I could at least minor in it. I came to really love theater, and I went through several majors my freshman and sophomore year. I was a bio major. I was an anthro major. I was a nursing student. I went through all of the different kinds of routes I could possibly take and kind of realized that that's not what I wanted to do. At that moment, I kind of just threw myself into theater. I immediately got involved with the department my sophomore year. I started doing a lot of student theater. I took a lot of different types of courses. So I took a lot of directing courses and reading performance courses. And I just came to really love all the different aspects of theater. The one thing that I had left was playwriting. It was a little bit daunting because I've always wanted to write and create. But I think it's one of the most vulnerable things you could do and really display it. So I finally took a course last year. It kind of changed the way that I felt about theater, and I kind of took myself more seriously as an artist, I think.
What are some of the things that you write about? What are some of those themes?
I think I write a lot about what I'm familiar with. So I know for me, like, family is something that's very important to me. Growing up, familial love has been just so important to everybody in my family. Like, we put each other first. And what I've noticed that in my writing is a lot of what I write about is about family and connection and culture as well, just because for me, one thing that's always been big is representation. I'd love to see more representation, you know, like on stage and behind the scenes as well. I find myself writing a lot about stories that aren't really often told. And this would include a lot of stories of people of color and people who are queer. That's kind of what I write about, just because they say write what you know. And it makes sense because it is what I know.
I know that Diane Glancy and Jack Dalton are both Indigenous writers who write about the Indigenous experience from all different angles. Were they saying anything that kind of turned on a light for you about writing representative characters?
One thing that they said that they really related on was kind of writing in general, playwriting, and how it's actual work. And so my thing, you know, has always been finding what I'm passionate about. Diane Glancy really, she really expressed how, although she loves playwriting, it is a job and it feels like work sometimes. And it's interesting how writers may not like to write, but that's what they do. I thought that was really important to hear. It felt very validating. For a long time, I was like, well, I'm not really enjoying this completely right now. Is this something I want to do? Do I like storytelling? But I think that the reason why it's so difficult is because you want to make sure that what you're representing is done right. You're very passionate about the story that you're telling. And so it can often become really difficult and you may dread to write the story you're telling. But I think that it just shows the passion you hold for the project. And so I think them just kind of validating how I felt really helped and opened me up to, I think, writing more. And so I hope to get in touch with my department soon about pursuing a research project that involves writing a full-length play.
Can you give us any little sneak peeks into what you might be writing your first full-length play on?
Sure. I thought about writing a play about a parent and child relationship. I was thinking of writing it in the eyes of, you know, Hispanic Latinx family, but specifically about the child going off to college. I want to write about the difficulty that it can be for a first generation student to leave for college and how difficult it can be for both the student and the parent. And so I kind of want to explore those themes. That's something I learned while I left for college, is that I'm the only one in my family who went to college, and I kind of saw how it affected my parents, which I didn't really think about prior to going. So that's something I'd want to explore, definitely.
That's amazing. What was that experience like for you? My father was one of the first in his family to go to college, and he moved from Baltimore all the way down to Atlanta. And it was a wild experience having been in the North, like yourself in mm-hmm. Chicago, and then found his way all the way down into the South.
Oh yeah. I feel very similarly. I mean, I didn't know anybody in Atlanta. I knew one person from my high school who started Emory a year prior, but it was a bit difficult in the beginning, but I was also very surprised at myself. I always felt like I didn't know what my limits were. And so for some reason I applied to Emory, and once I got in and decided I would be going there, it wasn't really scary until it actually happened. It just kind of surprised me at how much I pushed myself to go somewhere new, go somewhere that I'm not familiar with. But I think it ended up working out just for the better. It's been interesting. You know, I think that there's definitely been a large amount of culture shock while being on campus, just talking to people who come from different origins, learning that, you know, things are done very differently than back home, and people come from different kinds of neighborhoods. And so I think just learning that was very interesting, and also going through that journey of finding what I want to study. And I think that being away actually kind of helped me figure out what I wanted to do, because I didn't feel that necessary pressure from the people around me. You know, and I'd go back home and they'd ask me, that's when I would feel the pressure again. But everybody's been very supportive, and I'm very glad that I decided to go to Emory.
Nestor, thank you so much for talking with me and sharing your craft. And to our audience, please enjoy this edited down version of the conversation between Diane Glancy and Jack Dalton. For the full version, I will link the YouTube link.
This is an opportunity for you to talk with a couple of the playwrights that are brought in for the Global Voices readings. Our guests today are playwrights writing out of or in relationship to Native American traditions. And of course, part of what has to be recognized there is this is a very wide range of human experiences. And one way of talking about the differences here is to talk about the traditions reflected in these respective writers' work. So if you'll be patient for a moment, I will introduce you in those terms, and then we can actually start talking with each other. Jack Dalton joins us from Alaska and is by ancestry Yupik and part of the Alaskan Native tradition, which is distinctive in North American Indigenous life, First Nation life, not least because a lot of these people are able to live on their ancestral land. And with all of the incursions and all of the abuses of hegemonic culture surrounding and crowding them, nevertheless, they still are able in some ways to live on that land, to participate in its traditions and its very distinctive lifestyle. And so there's a connection to a kind of ancestral identity and a kind of clarity of what that identity and heritage is. Jack is a storyteller and an educator and has experimented in a lot of forms, including film. He participates in sketch comedy with other Native American performers in Alaska in a series that actually has several names.
The main name is Raven's Radio Hour.
Raven's Radio Hour. He's the author of, with the performance artist Allison Warden, he's the author and principal performers of Time Immemorial. Jack has done work as an actor, as a solo performance artist, as I say, an educator, particularly in Native communities, and so there's a very broad range of experience there. Diane Glancy comes to us from Texas and is Oklahoman and Kansan and Texan, and her work refers back to her Cherokee heritage, and we in Atlanta need to remember that as many streets as we have named Cherokee and areas of the city, this is where they were driven out. That tradition is a tradition of displacement and having been violated, having been deprived of history, deprived of land, deprived of any kind of simple identity. Other forces forcing themselves on this identity so that it is fractured and inconsistent and begins to be forcibly joined with other things that don't easily coexist with it. Diane is a poet. There are 20 poetry collections that I know of, a dozen plays, 20 novels and historical essays, and is a very considerable figure in American letters, having won the American Book Prize, Juniper Prize for Poetry, the Pushcart Prize, and it's a tremendous honor to have her here. So we're talking about very different artists, referring to very different heritages, and producing work absolutely distinctly their own. So before we start blending them together into something, let's welcome them as the very distinctive artists that they are. I want to ask, because both of you have such extensive work in a variety of forms of expression, I want to ask where you think playwriting is in your work, because you both do a lot of other stuff.
I think Jack will answer first.
I literally fell into playwriting, and I started off 18 years ago as I studied advertising in college, and then, because that was as close as I could get to art and the business degree that my dad wanted me to get, and...
None of you know what that's like.
So, within months of graduating, ended up, and giving the commencement address, ended up at a conference where I told a story in front of 3,000 indigenous people from around the world. It was unplanned, didn't know about it until minutes before it happened, and that's when I realized I was a storyteller. That's what I was gonna spend my life doing. And so I was a storyteller up until 2008, when my very good friend Ed Bourgeois, at the time, was at the Anchorage Opera, transitioning over to the Alaska Native Heritage Center, said, let's write a sketch comedy. And that's where Raven's Radio Hour came from. And then we were celebrating 50 years of statehood in 2009 and, or 2008, or 2009, and in 2008, when we were doing Raven's Radio Hour, the head of Cyrano's Theater Company in Anchorage asked me if I would write a play, the Native view of statehood, which I didn't know what to do, which is when I went to Allison Warden, and she had a brilliant idea about it, and that's where Time Immemorial came from. And then, since then, I've written three or four plays and working on an opera, and so it's funny how I fell into it, the same way I fell into storytelling, the same way I fell into acting, the same way all these things I just fall into, and so it's just fun to fall.
He's also very funny as Raven. I have heard him before. Do you sing also for your opera?
No, not for the opera. We sing in Raven's Radio Hour. I'm learning how to not be deathly afraid of singing in public, which, I mean, people, if you're an actor, you probably, and people say, well, how come you don't sing? They're completely different kinds of vulnerability.
Knowing Jack, it is difficult to imagine him being afraid of anything, but I'll take his word.
I tremor when I have to sing in public.
Well, I've had a long time to write, and I have noticed over the years that my themes have developed, and I'm very interested now in the development of Native theater. In the beginning, it was always a romanticized version of the Native American. One of my first plays was called Stoneheart, about Sacagawea, who traveled with Lewis and Clark in 1804 to 1806. And also, the Native is victim. I think that's a very early theme that you write about, a victim of history. And then after that, I wrote another play called Salvage, and it was about taking responsibility, that the Native himself was herself, were responsible for the alcoholism and a sense of disenfranchisement and all the problems that are rampant on any reservation in America. The place where I am right now, I wanted to write a Native play that did not look Native, and therefore that is The Birdhouse. It actually takes place in a church in Ropesville, Texas, and the main character is a minister. I've always been fond of the premise, hardship reveals character, and so I always take my characters through hardship. And then also, I thought, well, maybe this play is more about fracking, and I wondered if it were possible to have a concept play, because I live part-time in Texas where fracking is rampant because of the Barnett shale bed. I assume you know what fracking is. You send a pipe down through the bedrock and break up the shale and get to the natural gas underneath, which I know we need, and it gives people work, but it is disrupting the ground and possibly polluting groundwater. My son lives in the country in Texas and cannot drink the water there. We have to go up to Walmart in Decatur and buy these big gallon jugs, so you're also polluting with those gallon jugs. So anyway, I thought, can you write a play about an idea? And so I decided that I've written long enough, I can just do what I want to. And so I explored many different things. I think it's also important as a person that you read a lot and you know a lot of things. Education is very important. All the papers you have to write, all the things that you have to do in school that you may not want to, it will pay off someday. Do you want me to keep going, or do you
Of course
want
to we
continue?
Do.
There are two white South African writers, Nadine Gordimer, who I think has passed since then, and J.M. Coetzee. And they both wrote about apartheid, but in very different ways. Nadine said, it is wrong for people to come into a country and marginalize the indigenous peoples. And J.M. Coetzee did the same thing, but he wrapped it in fiction. He wrapped it in story. And I used that permission when I wrote The Birdhouse. One of his novels, for instance, In the Heart of the Country, there's a father and daughter, and the father, who's a widower, remarries and brings a new wife to the plantation and leaves the daughter out, and she spends a disastrous amount of time trying to get back into their lives, which is the story of apartheid in South Africa. So I would tell you all once again to do good work as students, because you need that foundation for your life. You need to know these things they ask you to learn.
Just on that, and getting as much knowledge as you can, we were rehearsing Assimilation, which is the play that is here up in Anchorage, and one of the actors said, what else are you working on? And I described the next play I was writing on, and he just looked at me like, how on earth do you come up with these ideas? And the director, Ed Bourgeois, rolled his eyes and said, oh, come on, guys, don't you know? He listens to NPR. And that's what I love about NPR, is you're getting so much knowledge about so many different things in a very accessible way. And then you're able to, if you want, you know, I go on what I call Wikipedia journeys, where I hear about something on NPR, whether it's Radiolab or To the Best of Our Knowledge, or now Invisibilia, which is this amazing new podcast. And then, you know, go research on Wikipedia about it and just find out everything I can. And that those turn into ideas that turn into plays, that turn into things that we sit here and talk about.
You know, so often I've had students, and they say, I'll be so glad when college is over, then I can do what I want to. Well, the bad news is you're going to be working on papers all your life and learning, and it's not fun to write, is it? It's work, and it's frustrating, and I have to do at least 25 drafts before I even get anywhere at all, and you just want to chuck it, but you have to just keep going. Yeah, I have more depressing news, so ask me.
You kind of just obliquely mentioned this, so that you have to do 25 drafts. I'm always curious about people's just actual process. You know, do you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sit and go to in front of a typewriter or a computer, write for 5 hours, and then go weed the garden? Or, you know, just how people actually do it. Because I think writing is a very solitary thing that has people attach rituals to it or ways in which they do it. I'm just always curious about that.
Except playwriting, that requires a lot of people. I can sit in my room by myself and do my poetry and fiction and essays. But when you write a play, and I've been very fortunate to work with Native Voices at the Autry, and we have also been at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. They've done four of my plays, and you send them a little preliminary work, and then they invite you out, and they have actors there, and they read it, and of course you just die of embarrassment, and you go back to your room, and you rewrite it. And then you come out again, and they read it again, and you still die of embarrassment, and you go back. And so that's a process that goes on for about 3 years, is what generally what it takes me to get a play up for production. And then we're still arguing at the end whether, you know, it's what you want or not.
We have very different styles of my parents said that when I was a kid, I would never just get up, I'd never try something. I didn't crawl, because why crawl when I could learn how to walk? And so, but then they said I wouldn't try and walk. I would sit there and they could see me studying it and thinking about it. And then when I was absolutely certain that I could get up and walk, I got up and walked. And my mom said that she was in the kitchen one day. We had a fireplace that created an island, and there was a living room, went into the dining room, went into the kitchen, went into the living room. And she said she was rinsing dishes one day and I walked past. No first step, no anything. And that's how I approach everything. I don't write my first draft until I've spent 18 months thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And the story then becomes so solidified in my mind, even though it might have gone through several different changes, and the characters become so real to me that eventually what happens is one day a character will start talking in my mind and I'll hear it and I'll go, oh crap, they're really talking now. And then I'll sit down and start writing. And then once that first character starts talking, well, then the other characters come in and they start talking. And then next thing I know, 3 days later, I have what's to me the first written draft. It's gone through God knows how many drafts inside my head. But it has to be in that form that's, because I'm a storyteller first, I don't write down my stories before I perform them. But they go around in my head and go around in my head. And then every time I perform it is a different draft. Because it's not a monologue that I memorize. It's a story that I know, and the story comes to life each time that I tell the story. And so the play, writing a play, is kind of like that for me. The first draft is the first time that story is being told. And then I'm lucky enough to have people like Michael Evenden as a dramaturg who asks these brilliantly subtle questions that make me go, oh, right. For instance, in Assimilation, he's got the first draft and he said, this is a great play and you have these five amazing characters and they all talk exactly like Jack talks. Help them find their own voice. So I said, okay. So I went back and I thought, okay, I'm gonna start with one of the characters, and Elder was the first character, and so I started, and I'm like, oh yeah, Elder would never say that. You know, how does Elder talk? And next thing I knew, the main thing I noticed was Elder would never speak in contractions. And so looking at contractions that Elder spoke, but would teacher use contractions? Well, she's a lot younger, and yeah, she probably might use contractions. And it's like, oh, we have subversiveness, we have rebellion, we have cultural change happening. And it's a cultural change that's really happening in the Yupik culture, where the Kuskokwim River villages are going with shorter versions of Yupik words, whereas my village, our area, is staying with the older, longer versions of the words, and they're talking about how, oh, so much is being lost in the language because those Kuskokwim people are shortening, you know, they're using contractions, essentially. And so that worked its way into play just from a dramaturg who knew how to ask a question that didn't lead me in any direction, but helped me to find what was really going on.
But this is also what it's like to raise a question or make a suggestion to Jack, because everything has 40 floors of thought underneath it. Nothing is a casual choice. It's a good thing I would never try to argue with him, because what would be the point? Well, I wanted to ask, and I'm not trying to force you into any kind of inappropriate self-description or anything like that, because I know that writers like to do their work and not necessarily explain their work. But one of the things that's fascinated me about Native writers generally is that this isn't a culture that has its own dramatic literature, and or at least its own, you know, its own traditions of dramatic literature that are in any way canonized or recognized by others. So there's a whole lot to be invented. there's a whole lot to be created in you. I wonder, do you think you write your plays in a way that is in conversation with the way you write your poetry or the way you write the novels and stories?
You know, I'm still amazed, as Jack explained his process of writing. Mine is absolutely different. I always wait until a fragment of something hits me. I know for The Birdhouse it was, "Near my heart is a tribe of aliens." And then I thought, what does that mean, and how could I follow it? And then later I was driving in Texas and I crossed the Yellow House River, and I wrote that down. I always have 100 different pieces of paper falling out of my purse and out of my pockets. Whatever genre I'm working in, it always starts with a gathering of fragments. Like underneath your bed, you have all these dust clumps that start to gather, and that's just the way my writing is. Then I was down in Texas babysitting with Ray, my son's grandchild, and we were out in the pasture, and the red ants start to bite your ankles, and they're fracking over in the next field. And a thought came to me. I try and always have a pencil and piece of paper in my pocket, of a boy pushing a girl out of the swing, which shows up in right. Birdhouse. I think the land carries memories. I think the land wants to be a part of a play, maybe just a native play. But I'm always informed by the land, and this is true in poetry and essay in whatever. It's like you're just in a dust storm and everything is swirling around, and you draw down this Yellow House River. That's got to be in the play. And let's bury them by Vernon. That's another town when I drive up 287. So I never think about anything. I might try your way, except I would forget it all. And it would. In Texas, you've got to get it down, you know, when it first comes to you, or it's gone. So that's quite amazing. I don't know if I answered your question, but I am a recipient of whatever falls out of the sky or passes on the road, or sometimes I hear somebody say something and it sparks something else.
Jack, is there a place that your, well, let's just talk about the storytelling part of your work. Is there a place that the storytelling is in conversation with the writing of plays for you?
I'm not exactly sure, other than the process is the same, except the difference between the playwriting and the storytelling is the drafts come out of performance as opposed to in the computer on paper.
Okay, I mean, it's interesting to me because, of course, in Assimilation particularly, there's a very important moment of storytelling, you know, that really is in many ways the idea climax of the play. And so it is a play and there's a story in it. And there are other stories referred to.
Right, Last of His Kind has a story central to it.
Yes, yes.
So I do believe that storytelling is important, and because that is a way, and it's true in Assimilation, it's true in Time Immemorial, it's true in Last of His Kind, that there is a story there because that story carries some kernel of, more than a kernel, carries the whole cob of truth for the culture that is being written about in that particular piece, whether it's a real culture like Inupiaq culture or Yupik culture, or the made-up culture of The Last of His Kind, which was fun to create that creation legend for The Last of His Kind. You know, what isn't a creation legend? But in terms of the stories themselves, I mean, they mostly come out of, you know, abstract thought. Okay. Assimilation came out of wanting to try and answer my mother's question about how come it's so hard for Native people to get over it. You know, my mom, I was adopted, my mom's white from Oklahoma, my adopted father's from Iowa, and I always say that, so they're not white bread, they're the grain that the white bread's made from. And it's fascinating having them as parents and me being as Native as I am, as Yupik as I am, that we're able to have these questions that spur me to think, well, what is going on? And so the idea, you know, really for Assimilation came from, I want my mom to understand what it's like to be in a boarding school. And maybe, and if only for 2.5 hours, and if she can understand that, then maybe she'll have a better understanding of what we are facing in terms of healing and in terms of putting everything back together to be healthy again.
But it's part of the, I think it's part of the Radiolab part of your imagination, that you love to write things in the future.
Yeah.
Or in alternative histories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the idea, which is why I'm so happy Assimilation is here. And because to you guys, when you see it, it's going to be science fiction to you, because the Yupik culture is so far removed from your way of seeing the universe. And so, you know, even if it were a Yupik play happening, we could watch Time Immemorial, and you guys would be science fiction to you, because it's so far out of your universe of seeing things. And so I like doing that. I like telling stories that show one thing, one aspect of humanity, but from a totally different perspective.
And I think on the other hand, you're talking about gathering things which you gather from the present. From, I observe this, and they want to come together and talk to each other. But one of the things that we're finding, you know, in the rehearsals for, rehearsals plural, for Birdhouse, is that there are these moments of lyrical reflection. I mean, there is very solid talking back and forth to each other and trying to win points and turning points in scenes and all the things we normally expect from dramatic dialogue. And there are these moments where they're off, you know, and they're off in description and they're off in reverie and they're off in memory. It makes perfect sense to me, you know, that you're working that way. But I think it is a way that your poetry is in conversation with what we think plays are supposed to be.
I was so happy that right off the bat you saw the movement of the voices and the rhythms, and then you saw the fracking that came in and broke it apart, and then it reconvenes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's wonderful.
More from y'all.
I was wondering if either one of you could talk about kind of, do you think specifically about issues of gender and sexuality as you write? I'm thinking there's such a rich tradition in Indigenous theater of like Lynn Riggs, Thompson Highway, Gloria Miguel, of thinking specifically about those issues. If that comes up, thinking about, I know in Diane, in your work, that kind of the way Marital and some of your characters engage in gender roles, if that's an issue, if you think about it.
I think Diane will answer that.
Yes, I'm interested in that, but what I'm always after is the story. Is you take a character and you kind of have to frack them. When you write, you always have to say, what is the worst thing that can happen to my character? What kind of depth can I send them into that they will come out on the other end somehow changed? And that's always the focus of my work.
It's a remarkably short answer. Yeah. For The Last of His Kind, I decided for it's not really the main character, but probably the, what would you call Losh?
Maybe central character?
Central character. I decided that he'd be gay, and I decided that because of the rich traditions in, A, because I'm gay, and I think that I want to get us back to a place where homosexuality is embraced the way it was embraced in traditional cultures. Most traditional cultures around the world, by making him gay in the play and then telling the story of the role that they had, that homosexuals, male and female, had within the cultures as a way of saying, look at this. This was actually a beautiful thing. This was something that was cherished in this, even though it's a made-up culture, it's drawn from so many different cultures that had these viewpoints towards homosexuality. And then you branch off into all the other different, you know, gender issues, whether it's matrilineal society and how, if you look at the matrilineal cultures around the world, they're actually usually much healthier than patrilineal or egalitarian societies because the Europeans didn't care about women. So when they colonized, they took all the power away from the men, and in a matrilineal society, that's fine. Those men didn't have much power anyway. Us women are going to keep going. So those are all really fascinating and diverse viewpoints around the world with all these different cultures on how you can, you know, work those things into, whether it's a play, whether it's any kind of work that you're doing, to discover, A, the diversity, but to me, most importantly, the acceptance of all those different aspects of gender and sexuality.
I do think that playwriting is a form in which a lot of Native writers are finding a voice, and a lot of the very good ones are women and gay men. I have no wisdom about this, it's just an observation. Could you talk really briefly about the gender casting?
Me talk briefly.
you're doing fine. About the gender casting of the elder in Assimilation?
Oh, okay. So I wrote Assimilation after Time Immemorial, which I also acted in for the three times we did it as a production, and including a tour of Alaska. And after that, I decided I never wanted to write and be in a play ever again. And so I decided that I was going to write Assimilation to make certain there was absolutely no way that I could act in it. So that was part of it. So there's three young white males and then two Yupik women. But the reason I wanted Elder to be Yupik, Elder to be a woman, is men and women carry emotions so differently. And for Yupik women, their emotions are always beneath the surface. There's very little outward expression of emotion. And so Elder carries with her this tremendous amount of anger, a tremendous amount of hatred, and a tremendous amount of righteousness. For a Yupik woman to be in that position of totalitarian power in the boarding school and to have all of those seething emotions, to put it into a Yupik woman's body. We had a Yupik woman, finally, the first production, we couldn't find a Yupik woman actor, so it ended up being an Aleut male actor. And his anger was very loud and half the time he was yelling. And then along comes Martha Jack, this wonderful, you know, tiny, petite, little, sweetest woman. She, like, after rehearsal, she would be sick because she was doing something so counter to her nature, but she would be on stage and she would just, she had this presence, this silent presence, and when she spoke those words, it just gave you the creeps because she was so calm about her hatred.
I'm sure about it.
She was so calm about her righteousness. The one that always creeps me out the most is after the beating scene when she says, you know, I like it so much more when the troublesome ones just run away. It's much easier to clean up. This is after she's just beaten two students and she's just like, oh, it's so hard to clean this mess up sometimes. And she does that in that Yupik way and it's just like, oh, wow.
Although to give credit to, I forget the name of the actor that first played Elder.
Ethan Pettigrew.
He did bring you some text that's now in the play.
He did. Yeah, and that's...
Because
we all lived that history.
Yeah.
And we all have ancestors from that history, and we're dealing with the fallout of that history. It's wonderful. That's a collaborative nature of theater that I really love.
Yeah, my question is for you. Last spring, Emory showed the fracking documentary. I forgot the name of it. But I was like really shocked and disgusted after I learned about what fracking does to the environment, especially the Halliburton connection. Does your play, unless people have seen the documentary, most of them aren't aware of that, does your play touch on the Halliburton connection?
No, not the Halliburton specifically. But he plays Rope. Jack plays the main character, Rope, who explains what fracking does, how they come in with their trucks and shave the grass down to the ground and put up a curtain so you can't really see what they're doing, and the pipe goes up and then it goes down and the whole ground kind of shakes. I'm saying all of your dialogue there, and the cows are mooing because they know something is wrong.
And it touches on the subject of fracking poisoning the water?
Yes. In Texas, you cannot even boil spaghetti in it because the little detritus won't go through the sifter. You know, after you cook your spaghetti, you pour it and drain it. You know, a play is not propaganda. It's not journalism. It's got to be a good story. It's got to be characters fracking and finding out who they are after their personal fracking. But I get as close to the issue as I can without, you know, it being a documentary on fracking. Each character is fracked in their own way.
It's very literally there. I mean, it really is in some ways the subject of the play, but it has a metaphoric valence too. It's happening personally, it's happening spiritually. It's both a historical, political, ecological document, and at the same time, a piece of poetry that uses fracking to describe larger wounds and larger issues.
And you know, there have been a series of minor earthquakes in Dallas, right around the old, I think it's the football stadium. And of course, all the people from the fracking company say it's not fracking. You know, it's just one of those oddities that we've had 43 earthquakes. You know, they're very minor, but still the ground is moving. But my main concern is the drinking water, because you force carcinogens into the ground. That's putting poison in the ground, and that is going to seep into the water levels, the greater water levels in our country. And I just think we don't know what we're doing in that area. But you can't stand on a soapbox and preach in a play, as I've explained. Well, I guess you can, but it wouldn't be the kind of play I wanted to write.
Well, it's a lot more subtle. I mean, that's what's brilliant about the Birdhouse is that it's so subtle, even though it hits you over the head with this really subtle hammer.
Diane, I have a question about writing novels versus plays. Can you just talk a little bit? You've written how many, 20-some novels?
A lot of them are novellas. They're very short.
And are the plays threaded throughout that process, or did you feel the playwriting was separate from the novel phase of writing? Or how does that all get woven together?
Well, it is a weaving, a braiding. I can work on many different projects in many different genres at once. In fact, I can't stay concentrated too long on one thing. I do a little bit of it, and then I put it aside, and then I get out the next project. And then in the morning when I get up, I know whether to go to a poem or a short story or an essay or a play or whatever. I think we work during the night, too. I think the subconscious is giving us ideas. The main novel, Pushing the Bear, started in New Echota, or maybe you say New Echota. I never did know the difference. Highway 75, about 50 miles, 60 miles north of Atlanta. I was there many, many years ago. It's a museum now, and I was in the museum, and I began to hear the voices of the past. I just started writing down right here in Georgia where that novel began, and then I drove all the 900 miles of the removal trail and took notes all along the way. You know, a piece here, a piece there, as I explained earlier. So I don't really know how to explain my process. It just all comes in a mix. And then I'm babysitting, and then I used to teach. I'm retired now. And then I have something else to do, and then I have to do my taxes and go to the dentist and whatever else, you know. And so it just comes out of the daily momentum of life, I guess.
Yeah, Dan, earlier you were saying, you know, your own writing process, and I was like kind of frustrated you didn't really enjoy it. It seemed like actually the writing itself, so why do you do it so prolifically?
Well, first of all, I think it's the only thing I can do. Words have always been what I have. You know, I don't know. Language is our most important possession. I think I've already said that. And I didn't know where else to go. I majored in English literature. I've taught English all my life, literature and creative writing. And I just have all these voices that want expression. I don't know. I can't do anything else. So.
I don't think most writers will admit that they enjoy the process of writing. I think it's handed to you when you enter the club. You have to tell people you don't enjoy this. Oh, I didn't get that memo.
It's work, you know, they say. What are you working on now? It's literal work.
Were you both raised in your native cultures, or did you discover them, or what was your sort of entry point? I mean, you mentioned having to go to boarding school, but also being adopted. You mentioned you had a, you know, your mother was Irish-German, so it's just...
I'm not traditional. I grew up in a very assimilated household. My mother was white, my father was Cherokee, but he was estranged. He came to Kansas City during the Depression for work. Uh-huh. I grew up in a regular school, elementary school, high school, went to the University of Missouri, University of Iowa, taught in a white college, although I taught Native American literature too all those years. But that longing, that the split and the longing for what was there, I've always had that to the bone.
I was visiting my mom a couple weeks ago, and she said, "We still get kind of creeped out when you talk about Yupik things, because we don't know where you learned it from, but you're so Yupik." I have no idea. It could be genetic. It could be spiritual. I had these night terrors when I was a kid and believed that it was my grandfather coming to visit me because I was taken away and he wanted to raise me, so that he came to visit me and like, this is everything you need to know about being
Yupik. Was that the grandfather with your name?
That's the grandfather that I'm now named after, and have recently, right at the solstice, went through a ceremony in which I accepted the mantle of Angakuk, or healer in our culture. And so now my focus has gone from being an entertainer, storyteller, playwright, which has always had the healing in there, to focusing on the healing and let whatever plays or entertainment or whatever or other projects come out of that. I think there's so much more, and I think you know, Diane in her way also feels it and knows it because of the way she talks about what she does. There's so much more happening than we know is happening, and it speaks, and all we have to do is listen and then give it voice.
I think it was probably 1946 or 7 when I started to school, and that was in the melting pot days when a lot of differences came together and we were all the same. Well, the problem with that is some things don't melt, like one's culture and voice and heritage and spiritual foundation and the ancestors and the land and everything else. So I'm very glad that we finally got to the place during the 60s, 70s, really maybe 80s, because then I had a job, because you had to teach all these different minority literatures and all. So I'm very glad that we're coming around. And it just keeps expanding the problems that we face. I was watching television the other day about the Jordanian pilot that was killed by ISIS. And I was in Syria in 1994. I was an Arts America speaker. And I could feel even then the unrest of students. I want freedom. Our world is in such a terrible shape right now with these things once again coming together, but on a much larger level. So what are we going to do with that? This is your generation now that are going to face growing problems.
Have fun.
Don't you just love
that? Oh, it's your problem. Good. Have fun with it.
I wish you could see him as the dressed up as a crow. You would believe he really was it.
There's so much going on that you don't know what's going on, and it's not a conspiracy thing. It's a beautiful, loving, the universe loves you. Just be open and listen and then do. Because it's talking to you. It talks to Diane. It talks to me. It probably even talks to Michael. And so it's talking to you. It's just about opening up and being ready to hear. And that's the way we're going to fight it, these things that are facing the world, you know. It's not about having ideas. It's about listening to the ideas that have always been there. And that's where healing is.
More questions from students?
The professors all have such wonderful questions.
Then ask a naive one, and then we'll show you what a wonderful question it is.
All right. Would you suggest, like, young playwrights who are trying to find things to write about reconnect with their cultures if they have some kind of culture that's a little bit strange? Do you think that is helpful, or?
Diane will answer this.
You ask him, but I will answer. I think the most important thing is to be educated and to start making a list of the things that haunt you, or the things that you don't want to write about, or the things that you don't know how to get into, or the things where you really feel you shouldn't be in. That's exactly what you should do. And just ask permission of language, of your words, of your craft, of your talent, of your aesthetic, of your observant imagination. And think a lot about the creative process, how to feed it, how to develop it. Do not give up. If I could just say four words and leave, that would be it. Because I think I've already said how long it takes me to get to a finished product. I used to do this in class. I would take in a pile of papers and then the little short story that came from all those drafts, because I don't do it in my head. And they would get so discouraged. And then I would take in all my rejection slips. I have a whole folder. You know, I would send out a short story and get it back. Just to let the students know what the writing community is like. So much competition and so hard to get a footing. And many talented students, I think, give up too soon. And if you are tenacious, and if you have a voice, and if you have these hauntings around you, I'm really concerned about this issue, and you just follow that thread. Sometimes it's a little thin trail you can hardly see in your life, but if you keep with it, you too will have some play someday, and you will be sitting here informing everyone of whatever.
I mean, I do want to say that one of the things that I went to Native American playwriting hoping I would find, and have found in abundance with the best writers, is originality of thought, but also originality of form. And it really is why I asked about, you know, whether your other work informs your work. I think I've worn Jack out with, I published about assimilation, that I think there's a kind of a dialogue going on between the Western tradition of tragedy and the tradition of indigenous storytelling in the form of the play. And I think the final image of the play is very directly an opposition of those things. The different ways of telling stories on the stage and in a storyteller are fighting it out in the play. And I don't know if you agree with that, but it's part of how I perceive it. And similarly, in Birdhouse, I mean, I suppose we could say that there are other playwrights that it reminds one of, but no. And there is this very specific, very interesting way that these liftoffs into poetic reverie or observation that needs metaphor and needs imagery to land keeps happening. And I think it is by listening very authentically to what is speaking to you, mm-hmm. and not writing what other people are writing.
Exactly.
And it is so difficult for people who write in dramatic forms now because there is so much out there. But it is so conventional, and it is so much built on the same models over and over again. And part of what I love about these writers, when they are really living their game, is that the form follows the inspiration, and that the form follows the material that speaks to you. And therefore, these plays are not like everybody else's plays. And of course, this is the thing that always makes me nervous in play development programs and things like that, because there are all kinds of people who have great ideas for you and great ways to help you turn this play into an ordinary play and great ways to tell you to turn this play into a thing that would sell for a television movie in a second. And I think it takes so much integrity, you know, and so much clarity to listen to what is speaking to you and not to listen to all that helpful advice that will make your work somebody else's.
I think everybody here also will face the eraser that you know, you have your way to go, and I don't know whether it's the cares of the world or different people saying you should go this way or that way that would erase what it is that you have to do. I think it's also important, maybe at night as you go to sleep, ask yourself, what is it that you should be addressing? What are you here to do? And you will find that you tell yourself eventually, if you don't let it be erased. And never think anything is too small either. Oh, that's not a very important issue. But sometimes it's in the very ordinariness that the important stuff is.
If you speak the truth, truth is whatever truth is for you. As long as it's your truth, then it doesn't matter what, if you're approaching it from a cultural point of view, a sexual identity point of view, a gender point of view, a socioeconomic point of view, you know, it doesn't matter then, because it's your truth. It's coming from you, directly from you. And then, the, you know, whatever form it takes. You know, if you look at any literature or anything cultural that's truly popular and successful because it speaks to something, you see that it's popular because it's telling the truth. Then you notice how everything after that tries to mimic it. That's why we've had Shakespeare teen movies and teen novels since the 1400s. Because Shakespeare spoke the truth. And so whatever it is for you, speak your truth. And if you speak it true enough, which is why you have to get to those scary places, that's when someone like a professor or a producer or someone looks at it and goes, holy crap. And they'll be like, I have no idea how I'm gonna stage this. Yeah. I have no idea if people are gonna understand this form, but this is the truth.
I think we should thank our guests.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Creativity Conversations. This podcast was brought to you by Emory University and Arts at Emory. It was produced by Emma Yarborough and me, Maggie Becker. For the full version of this conversation, you can find it on the Creativity Conversations YouTube playlist linked in the description of this episode. For more from Arts at Emory, be sure to follow us on Facebook at Arts at Emory and on Instagram at Emory Arts.